across the continents and through the centuries to the homelands that God had in mind for them from the beginning, outside of Israel, when they expanded large enough that they would need to colonize. So we're looking at that, and what's up on the screen, which is where we'll start right after the opening prayer here in a moment, is one of the tools of historical research. We're looking at a series of those. We will be going at rapid fire, so this is going to be a blitzkrieg coverage today, but I think you'll be able to keep up with it with a handout. Okay, if you'll all rise, we'll go ahead and ask God's blessing on our study. Heavenly Father, we give you thanks this beautiful morning during the Feast of Tabernacles for another time, extra time for spiritual instruction and understanding how you work in history and how you have worked with the history of the nations that descended from the tribes of Israel. And certainly, Father, then from that great lesson, how you work with all nations and frankly with each and every one of us. For if you can fulfill your promises to Abraham through your nations, then you certainly will fulfill them to us. We give you the praise and the glory. We look forward to your great kingdom when we see everybody understanding who they are and marveling in that and being happy about the knowledge. And we pray for that kingdom to come, and we do that in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Okay, what we covered yesterday, just to do a rapid-fire review, we looked at the Bible as a superstructure of history. We're all descended from Adam and Eve. God has made us of one blood, all nations on earth. And he planned the boundaries of the nations. We also noted that when he did that, he had in mind, in Deuteronomy 32, to plan for the numbers of the children of Israel. He would choose a model nation. And that nation then would need a place to live. And so he made plans for that. We looked at the tracks in Israelite history, going through a quick survey of the history of Israel from the time of the Exodus into the conquest of the Promised Land, and then the Song of Deborah in Judges 5, where she comments that Dan had ships and that Asher was in his harbors or inlets, meaning that both of those tribes that had their inheritance in the Promised Land on the seacoast of the Mediterranean were sailing tribes. Colonizers. Bear in mind, Dan in particular was a colonizer. Because in the book of Judges, you remember the story, the troop of Danites, about the size of a regiment, 500 or 600, went into the center of the country, because their land was over on the Mediterranean, near where Tel Aviv is today, went to the center of the country and went up the main sort of mountain ridge route. It's a highway that goes up through there. And found one of the descendants of Moses, who was, of all things, a pagan priest for a local landowner. So he had this really cool-looking image. They stole that and decided, well, you're coming with us too. And they were going to find a place where they had more space. And they went all the way to the north edge of Israel. And they found a city called Leshem, is one of its versions, and Laish is the other one. The words mean the same place. So he even shows you there how two names that sound somewhat similar apply, you know, can mean the same thing. And they decided, you know, we'll just kill everybody here, and this will be our town, and we'll call it after Grandpa Dan. And the tribe of Dan named everything after Dan, and that's what we're going to be getting into here shortly. That was one of the items we covered. We covered the fact that not only did Dan and Asher sail, but in Solomon's day, he and his fleet and the Phoenician fleet of Hiram sailed, and they made three-year journeys or voyages, which is how long it takes to circumnavigate the globe, to sail around the world. We found that later in the time of King Omri and King Ahab, that the king of Judah at the time was Jehoshaphat, and he made a fleet of ships for sailing in conjunction with Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, and then God crashed the fleet before it ever left the harbor, probably a big storm, because he did not want Israel and Judah in that alliance. But it shows that the northern Israelites in the 800s BC were active sailors and still in league with the Phoenicians in that regard. And the Phoenicians were phenomenal sailors. And some of the research on the triemes means three levels of oars. Baim would have two levels of oars. Triem is three decks of oars. that the Phoenicians used, that some of their big deep-sea vessels were 600 feet long. In World War II, we had an aircraft carrier called the, the Guadalcanal. In the Vietnam era, it was used as a helicopter carrier. I got to tour it one time. It was 600 feet long. The Mayflower, which brought the Puritans to America, was 100 feet long. So the Phoenicians had big boats, big boats. And thus the northern Israelites would have had access to that as well. So what we're going to start right now into is the tribal and clan names. And we're going to turn on the clicker. There we go. Look at a few of them. We have Reuben here. Basically, I want to show you the outline of this. We've got Reuben, and then Rahubani, Rubari, and Ruby. These settled near where Paris is today. But that's their variations of Reuben. And you can see that. You can see, okay, it moved through many centuries, probably a language shift or two, but you can still see Reuben in those names. The sons of Reuben are listed on the left by the dots, Hanok, which in Hebrew would be pronounced with a C-H, Chanak. Chanach, something like that. Palu, and Palu's son was Eliab, Hezron, and Carmi. Those were all sons of Reuben. Just to give you an idea of how we're doing that. Now, what we have here, we have on this, past the little dashes, you have names that are taken from groupings of Celts or Scythians as they were moving into Europe. They appeared on historical atlases. Those are the names they appeared under. So what we look for on the historical atlases are names of peoples, tribal subgroupings, that look similar to one of the clans of one of the tribes, or even the tribal name itself. So that's Reuben as an example. Simeon is another one. We find that Simeon were known as the Samnites in Italy. If you can imagine Italy in your mind's eye, as a boot, because it looks like a boot, and it's going to kick this triangular soccer ball, which is Sicily. But on the back of the boot, right in the mid of in the upper part of the calf, if you can imagine a spider bite there, they got all inflamed. That would be the Samnite kingdom, which the early Romans, who were called Latiums, didn't like very much. So they fought for hundreds of years with each other, and eventually the Samnites left. And went somewhere else. Bear in mind, the Israelites, as wanderers, were pretty good at it. When they got under pressure, they'd go wandering. At times, they would just load up and sail, or load up and move an entire population. And that happened numerous occasions. One of the key occasions was a Viking king. Now, not all Vikings were Norwegians. In fact, you didn't know of anybody as a Norwegian or a Dane or a Swede at the time because of the national identities hadn't forged yet. They were a confederation of various tribes. But there was one Viking king who at the time lived in Normandy, or not in Normandy, in what was called now Norway, about halfway up Norway. And he went on a Viking. A Viking was an expedition. It's basically what the word means. And in his case, he sailed down the channel, and he sailed up the Seine toward Paris, which took him right past what is called now Normandy. He had enough Viking soldiers with him that he threatened Paris. So the Frankish king at the time called for a truce and said, if I gave you that land out there by the ocean, would you leave Paris alone? And the Viking king was a businessman. Sure, that sounds like a fair deal. So he went home, got all his people in their boats, and they all sailed down, and they settled in what is now Normandy. They became known as the Normans, who then later invaded England under William the Conqueror. We believe that they were Benjamites, an element of Benjamin. Bear in mind, most of Benjamin is still among the Jews. But there were elements of Benjamin taken into captivity at one time or another with the 10 tribes. Or in 700, 20 years afterwards, a number of the Jews and Benjamites, the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, were taken into captivity by Esarhaddon, I think was the name of the Assyrian king at the time. That was the time of King Hezekiah. So that was an example of where they just moved, lock, stock, and barrel, shifted to a new location. Not uncommon. Samnites did a similar thing. Now, you notice the Samnite, you've got there, Semeni. That tribal grouping showed up in England. They fought with the Romans a lot. Eventually, the Romans conquered them, but they fought with the Romans. Here we have the sons of Simeon. And this is instructive, and this is another key on how we study the history of the tribes. Nemuel, found later in Europe as the Nemeti, Yamin, and I'll pronounce the J as a Y, as it would be in Hebrew, and Yamin is the name of his son in Numbers. Notice the parenthetical name, Yemuel, that's from Chronicles. Remember yesterday we found that the genealogies of the tribes are listed in Numbers 1 and 26. Census is taken at the time, at the beginning of the wandering, at the Exodus, and then at the end when they were ready to go into the Promised Land. And then 400 years later, in the time of David, you find the genealogies that are listed in Chronicles. And this is why reading genealogies is so much fun when you're reading through the Bible, because you get to track all these cool names. So Yamin is now Yemuel, and that was a change that took place within the Hebrew language culture, but it took four centuries. So you see names move, and yet you can recognize Yamin, Yemuel, you got the Yam core at the beginning, and there was a Viking grouping that was different than the other Vikings that were called the Yam Vikings many centuries later. So that would be a very good connection. Yam, Yamin, Yemuel, Yam, shortened to Yam later. Yakin became Yarib. And the Yakin, you see here, bear in mind, you have the core. In Hebrew, we have consonants. And then you can plug vowels in, which can make a two-syllable word into a three-syllable word pretty easily. The Aseni and the Semeni fought against the Romans a lot in Britain. And then later, the Angles and Saxons pushed them more toward Wales, and then some of them didn't want to go to Wales in 500 AD, so they sailed back across the English Channel, lock, stock, and barrel, except they didn't have locks, stocks, and barrels yet. Guns hadn't been invented, so that's no muzzleloader nomenclature. They all went back over there and formed what is now Brittany, which is next to Normandy. They were called Britons. The ancient Celts were called Britons, which means, in Hebrew, Brit. The BRT sound is covenant. And an or am, Britan or Britam, means people, covenant people, or covenant men, as it were. So they took their name and went over to Brittany. He also had Zerah, who became, by the time of Chronicles, Zohar. And the Zarate, we find that name is pretty obvious. That was also found in Europe. And Shaul became Siluris. Or I don't know if I'm saying that one right, but that would be a variation that was found on the historical maps. So that's the key. You're looking for the names that are found in Numbers and in First Chronicles, chapters 2 to chapter 8. And looking for them on historical maps as peoples moved and migrated. This is a Samnite warrior. This is excavated in Italy, just an image of what they look like. Gad would be pronounced not Gad. Most languages don't have a flat A like Americans have. They have a longer A, so it's odd. It would be God. Except it wouldn't be, the D comes out, especially in Hebrew, as a T, Gott. That's the German word for God, but it was also the way Gad was pronounced. Also, when you shift a different vowel in there, you get the Guti. The I on the end means the people of. The Massa, or Gete, A-E. Massa Gete is a combination of Manasseh, it would seem, at least, and Gad. Now, that was a tribal confederation in the, let me see, 600 to 400s BC, 600 to 300s BC. The Massagete, very powerful. They were actually the ones who killed King Cyrus of Persia because they were in a battle with him, in a war. They migrated northeast out of Iraq-Iran territory where they'd been taken captive. They migrated up to China, and they fought with the Chinese for several hundred years. They built a wall to try to keep them out. And the Chinese, in the Chinese records, called them the Yiqi, which is probably, if I understand Chinese right, the way they're trying to say Guti, and the gu is not coming out, comes out Yu, Yiqi. So the Yiqi name there is what the Chinese called them. They also became the Gutons or the Gedeni, and they also were the Goths. It wasn't that all the Goths were Gadites, it was that their tribal name became sort of a supreme tribal name for a while, with a lot of different ones under that. You'll see here as well that his sons in Numbers, many of them had different, slightly different names in Chronicles, in the parenthesis here. And then the rest of these names are what we find on historical atlases in Europe, Scandinavia, and other places. Judah. Here we have Judah produced the Jutes. There is the scripture, 2 Kings 18. That's when it wasn't Esarhaddon, it was Sennacherib, emperor of Assyria. 20 years after Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom, fell, they came to take Judah as well. But God wasn't going to let them take Judah. They did take the fortified cities. And according to the cuneiform inscriptions that have been discovered, they claim to have taken over 200,000 Jewish people captive and hauled them off to the usual places that they dumped their people, up in the center of their empire or on the borders of it. But they took the fortified cities there in 701 B.C. That's about 20 years after Samaria fell. Now, the Jutes, we therefore will have an element of the tribe of Judah scattered with the ten. So we're looking for the name of the Jutes, or of the Jews. And when the Anglos and the Saxons invaded England, which wasn't called England, it was called Britain then, invaded Britain and fought with the Celts to establish for themselves a new homeland, the Jutes came with them. So it was the Anglos, the Saxons, the Jutes, and a few Vandals and a few others. Okay, Zebulun. Before it was Afghanistan, in the ancient times, it was called Zebulistan. Afghanistan, the A-F-G-H sound, is probably a variation of Yosef, Yosefistan, which could be named after the tribe of Joseph. So in Scythian times, it was called Zebulistan. The Sabalingue, you look at that, and you saw, well, that's an S. It's not a Z. S's and Z's are very similar, aren't they? And the sounds are very similar. So you're thinking phonetically. How would a name be named, spelled? Now, when you come down the line, let me get the right pointer here. He had Pered, Elon, and Yahil. Now, we find these names on the maps. Elon, which, notice Elon is basically the last part of Zebulon, remembering that the vowels can change. Elon was one of his sons from... In the migrations, as the Scythians began to move into Europe, there was a grouping known as the Alans, or the Alani, meaning the Alan people. And sometimes they were called the Roxalani. Ultimately, they became known as Aland. Now, Zebulun is a good example of tracking tribes because we know that he is to be a haven for ships. That's from Genesis 49. The dead ringer for that is Holland. Rotterdam was the world's largest harbor up until just a few years ago. I mean a handful of years ago. Some other place became more of a harbor. Dan. Dan would be a judge and a serpent or a viper in the path, meaning that if you looked in the dust of a trail, a path, and you saw a zigzag pattern, you'd start looking for a snake. Snake tracking is fun too. Now, Dan only had one son. His name was Shuham, or Shuham in Numbers, but notice how his name changed in Chronicles, in the parentheses. Husham. Now that's a big change, it seems to me, but that's de rigueur for the Israelites. Now, talk about the zigzag pattern. Dan, as we'll get into it in a minute, there's a historical tradition, used to be taught as historical fact in Britain up until about 1900, was that before or at about the time of the Exodus, part of the tribe of Dan sailed out of Egypt. You think, well, how could they sail? They're supposed to make bricks. Not all the slaves would make bricks. Remember, the Israelites lived in the Delta, the Nile Delta up here. And that's where Egypt sailed in the Mediterranean. They would use slaves as the oarmen or the galley slaves in running their ships. So slaves would learn to sail in the course of time. So the tradition is that they sailed up into part of southern Greece and established colonies. And part of the Greeks say that they descended from the Danoi. The other part of the Greeks say that they descended from Javan, and they probably did, which was an element of Japheth, the European edge of Japheth, so to speak. But the Danoi has got the Dan label all over it. But notice the tribe of Dan. You've got Adana here, and when you get into the Black Sea, all the rivers are named after Dan. You have the Danube, you have the Dunaspetrov. I think that's the Dnieper, or Dnieper, or Dniester. That might be the Dniester. Then you have the Don River here, and the Donne, which is a part of one of the tributaries of the Don. All of the rivers are Dan names, the D-N sound. D-N together, or a Don, or Dan, or Din sometimes. But remember, consonants is what you had in ancient Hebrew, so the consonant syllable is what you're looking for. D-N, D-N, Don, Don there, Danube there, Dana there, Danzig in Poland, Denmark is Dan's mark, Dunkirk down here in France, London, Tuatha De Danann was early Celts in Ireland, tribe of Dan is what that means, Donegal Bay or Danegal Bay, Don River in Scotland, the Dundee, Private Dundirk of Dundee. Was something as something could be. There's a famous limerick about Private Dundirk of Dundee. That's only a sampling. If you started studying your historical atlases looking for Dan names, you will find a lot of them. It's just like a serpent in the path. You can see the trail zigzagging along. Again, this talks about what I just summarized, that the Dan were colonizers. They colonized the city of Dan. Some sailed from Israel to the Black Sea and on to Ireland and colonized Ireland as Tuatha De Danann. Ephraim. Ephraim had a symbol of the bull. That was on their standard as the tribes traveled in the time of the wilderness. The bull in Hebrew is Egel. Hence, you end up with people named after the bull. You got the Egloi, the Angli, and the Angles. You can see how an N sound can come into the AE sound very easily. They were known as Angles by the time they invaded Britain. So that would have been around 500 AD. And then England is simply another morphosis of Angleland. It became England. Hence, the Anglo term we use today is all derived from Egel. And here's the key that we use, Jeremiah 31:18. This is God speaking. I have surely heard Ephraim bemoaning himself. You have chastised me. And by the time of Jeremiah, remember Jeremiah was in Jerusalem 120 or 30 years after the tribes had been taken captive. So this is a historical comment, and thus also a prophetic one. Ephraim bemoaning himself, you have chastised me. I was chastised like an untrained bull, like an eagle. That's what eagle means. Restore me, and I will return, for you are the Lord my God. And a time will come when Ephraim will be restored, as well as the other tribes. Ephraim's clan, this is fairly interesting. His son Shutala, his grandson Eran, Becker, here, and Tahan. From Tahan, we get the Tutans and the Tutaris and the Tahuni. So most people think modern Germans are the only Teutons. No, not by any means. The term Teuton was used long before Germany ever coalesced into a nation. And the tribes who live in the area of modern Germany were called Teutons. They moved on, but the name stayed back. The Germans came in later, the modern Germans. Bear in mind, most nations are a melting pot to some degree. The Israelite nations will tend to be more of a melting pot because they've tended to have more tolerant cultures, America being a classic case in point in that regard. Now, notice Edon. That was a variation of that. That's the early name for Ireland. Edon, Iran, and these three are peoples that were found in Iraq, Iran territory way back in Scythian times. The Iran, the Ari, the Hiri, and then you've got the modern name Iran is a variation of Iran itself, a name that stuck in the territory even though the people had moved out. Tehran, the capital of Iran, similarly, and Erin. So those are all historical names that we find on different atlases. Manasseh, Joseph, Yasubi, Yaspoi, Yasfuzi, Esparkeri, Aspazi, Swaif Swabi. You're looking for that SF sound that is the last part of Joseph. Remember, the J in Hebrew would be pronounced like we would say a Y. Thus, it becomes more of a vowel than a consonant. Manasseh, however, we would look at Manas, Mani, and the Massageti would be connected with the Goths. Now, Manasseh had one main son. His name was Machir. And he had a grandson named Gilead. Now we get into something interesting. Here are Manasseh's clans. Merikanda in the Tarim Basin, which is on the Silk Road. It would be in Kazakhstan, I think, north of Afghanistan today. Up in that territory, there was a town named Merikanda, or Merikand. Samarakand, Samaria is what that is, the variation of Samaria. Thus, you're looking for people who used to live in Samaria that would have transplanted the name of one of their cities elsewhere. We have an interesting collection of his sons, Yezer, Abiezer. This was his chronicle's name, Yezer. Shechem became Sechem. Sikumbi, Sikambri, those were in Britain. The Zelophehad was also one of the sons, and he had daughters. And the daughters were named here. Maha, Thirza, Hogla, Milka, Noah. And you will find them, they're mentioned in Numbers. They wanted to know if they could have the inheritance of their father because they had no brothers. And God said, yes, but you got to marry in the tribe. And so they did. But you will find some of their names popping up on maps as well in some variation. Now, how Manasseh became America, the homeland of America. We know by prophecy that it has to be America. The name for the people of Machir is pronounced Hamakiri. Well, that's really close to Hamerica, isn't it? America. The Amerigan Siths are the Siths or the Scythians that would have been of part of Machir or part of Manasseh. Another language, they called them the Emirigoskute, or in Babylonian language, the Gimiri Urmuga. Urmuga being the Machir name. In Saxon Germany, you had the Umurgi, which again is a variation of Machir. The Meerings, the Meers, the Meringas, and Merkia in Britain. They were very dominant, settled in Britain. Now, how Amerigo became Vespucci, because that's where it became Vespucci, became America. We've been taught in high school and grade school that the name America comes from the name of a map maker of the 1500s, and his name was Amerigo Vespucci. Nice Italian name from Venice, I believe he was from. Now, never mind that he was a commoner. Commoners' first names were hardly ever attached to a place. Their last name might be, but not their first name. The first name of a royal, a king, or even a prince or a queen, that would be attached to a land, like Georgia, right over here. It's named after King George. So you use his first name. But why isn't this place called Vespuccia or Vespucciland? Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. Before that, the English fishermen out of Bristol, England, sailed over and were fishing off the coast of Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and possibly even down off of Maine and what would be later Massachusetts. They knew North America was there before Columbus found it. They had a leading ship builder in the 1480s, whose name was Richard Amerique. And the captains of the ships that sailed, because he led the shipbuilders' guild, so he was the dominant ship owner. He ran Bristol, basically, especially the shipping industry. And so it would have been logical that they might have put his name on that massive land over there, well before Columbus ever got there. Later, the Bristol shippers helped to sponsor the trip of Jean Cabot, who led three of their sailing their fishing ships on an excursion mapping the East Coast. At the same time that was happening, a particularly bloodthirsty Spanish admiral was bringing a flotilla of Spanish ships north, up the Gulf and around somewhere on the East Coast. They may have met May because the English ships never came back. The Spanish ships were carrying Amerigo Vespucci. He was the cartographer for this particular admiral. So the argument by one historian is that they would have taken the maps, were very valuable knowledge. They would have taken the maps from the ships that they ran against, the English ships, if they had vanquished them, and which they might have at that time. And so it was called America, so it was called America because of that. So it could be that it was named after Richard Amerique. Or it could be that the school is right. It's named after Amerigo Vespucci. Because who was Amerigo Vespucci? He made maps. He was also Jewish. Jewish people were the most educated during the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance as well. And furthermore, he was named after a famous Jewish prince. Back about 400 years or a little more earlier, in around the time, about 800, when Charlemagne was in power as a Frankish king and fighting the Moors, which were the Mohammedans moving north through Spain trying to get into France, there was a key kingdom called Narbonne, which was on the border. It kind of straddled the Pyrenees of France and Spain on the Mediterranean side. It was a key place that needed to be in place to protect Europe from the invasion of the Moors. And Charlemagne, who tradition says was actually half Jewish himself, was advised by his also Jewish wife to import some princes of Judah from back in the territory of Babylon or Israel, in the Middle East, in other words. And so he did. And one of them became the dominant ruler of Narbonne, and his name was Machir. He was a hero of the Jewish people at that time. Amerigo was named after him. So, according to that, then, Amerigo is named after Machir, and thus America is still named after Machir. Either way, the son of Manasseh. So that's the best understanding of how America got its name. Here's the key point we need to make, and we're going to shift to the other part of another PowerPoint. God sifts. I will command and will sift the house of Israel among all nations. God knows where the Israelites are. He knows which tribes of the Gentiles and where they are. He keeps track of all that stuff because he just can do it. He's God. He's eternal. Has that power. And as grain is sifted in a sieve, yet not the smallest grain shall fall to the ground. So we know that God is in charge of all of that. That's the end of part one. Now I need to shift to part two. Well, that looks good. We'll do that one. Okay, Tribe Trackers part two. How are we doing for time here? Oh, boy. I'm going to talk faster now. Review, blah, 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 blah. Okay, got that. Blessings of the best places and things. This is a key track as well. One that we have in the booklet, actually, so we won't spend a lot of time on it. But God promised that the greatest blessings would go to Abraham, or to Joseph of the tribes. It would go to Joseph because Joseph got the birthright, which meant a double portion of everything. Best buddy had a responsibility. He had to look after the clan as a result. That was what the son who got the birthright was required to do. So here is a summary. The British Empire, at the end of the Empire era, 1939, right at the beginning of World War II, controlled or owned 25% of the land surface of the earth and ruled 20% of the population. No other empire has approached that. Roman? No. Soviet Union? No. Vast resources of America, vast resources of the British Empire, you know, natural resources. Gates of their enemies. We already know about land gates, mountain passes. Those were strategically important for land warfare. Sea gates, straits, strategic islands like Guadalcanal and even the Hawaiian Islands and so on. Singapore, Hong Kong, those were all key sea gates. But what we have in our modern era, which we haven't necessarily thought as much about, America and Britain, particularly America, has controlled the air and space gates. After World War II, America established a series of strategic air bases for the U.S. Air Force all around the world. Some of those have been closed, normally because they have extended-range bombers or things like that where they don't need them, like the big one they had in the Philippines that they closed some time ago. But they are still strategically positioned. Some of the bases were closed because we opened another gate up, satellites in space, that gives America eyes and ears on what's happening. And that's a major gate of information, as well as a strategic military gate. So best places and things and the strategic positioning and the gates of their enemies, by the way, that comes from Genesis, where that's a prophecy that God gave Abraham that his descendants would have control the gates of their enemies. And that's happened. Legends and traditions. We talked about the tribe of Dan. Sailed to Greece some before the Exodus. May have become the Spartans, maybe, and possibly even the Trojans. Danoi is what they claim their descendants from. We know that the Black Sea was colonized during the time of Judges in the 1200s. Mostly they say the Greeks colonized it. Well, it did, but some of the Greeks weren't like the other Greeks. They were Danites. And then the tradition also says that a descendant of the king of Troy, after his defeat by the Greeks, left to found Rome and then went on and founded London. The tribe of Asher, and it is Asher, but it's actually a conglomeration of the other tribes, too. This gets into Viking mythology. Odin was a priest king. In 1st or 2nd centuries B.C., ruled the Asar, or the Asiya men. Hence, we think it's from the tribe of Asher. That's where the word Asia comes from, by the way, is Asiya men. Asher on the Asgard, which was on the river Don. Don was in the northern part of the Black Sea, if you'll remember that map. The Don River is sort of on the northeast corner of the Black Sea. And Asgard has another name, Tanais, T-A-N-A-I-S, which is probably cognate or phonetically interchangeable. The D and T sounds are hard to tell apart as well when they're spoken. Led his people to the Baltic Sea, north to the Baltic Sea. Interesting, there's a Dana River that empties into the Baltic Sea. It would have been on the direct route up. The Baltic Sea, which is, you know, the bottom of Scandinavia, at the time of Christ, and he ruled Saxland. Saxland would be what would be today northern Germany and southern Denmark in that area. He left two of his sons there, Vigdeg and Beldeg, to rule Saxland. And then Thor and Freya, his wife, and the others, they went on up. He had lots of sons, and they were all leaders at that time. This is the pre-Viking era. They weren't Vikings yet. They were migrating settlers, but they were fairly warlike. Now, Vegdeg and Beldeg, we go to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, one of the oldest English language histories, traces Anglo-Saxon genealogy to Woden. That is the Anglo-Saxon way of saying Odin. And so Wednesday is named after him, Woden's Day. Friday is named after his wife Freya. And Thursday is named after his son Thor. But I don't think anything's named after Vegdeg and Beldeg, which is, you see the variation in parentheses, you have Vegdeg and Beldeg, and in the English way of writing it, Old English, is Vegdeg and Beldeg. So again, we have these connections that lead us from the Middle East, through the wanderings, up into Scandinavia, over into Great Britain, and on. Art history. My daughter is an art historian. Part of her degree is in that. She's has a history degree from the University of Oregon. She had to study a lot of art history, though. Art historians are right now some of the better historians because most history classes are nothing but sociology. They want to rewrite history according to modern 21st century political correctness. So they're not interested in what happened. They're interested in spinning it all to make them look good. And so they're useless when it comes to the study of history. With all due respect, they're just flat useless. However, art historians don't care about that. They want to know what happened, when, and how did it affect the art. So she said she used to get more hard history out of art history classes than she got out of history classes. The Scythians are noted for their vigorous art style, which was one of the formative influences in the development of the Celtic art of Europe. Scythian burials such as those under the mounds of Pazrik in Russia, because that would be off toward Siberia, and the Scythians ranged way out into the steppes of Russia when they were a mobile society, a semi-nomadic society, for hundreds of years, longer than America has been a country by far. And then they would bury their chieftains and their princesses and things like that, and they've excavated some of those Scythian burial grounds. They're very elaborate, contain many artifacts decorated with fantastic animal motifs. That is of particular importance because you'll find that that's common in Scythian art. This is a famous Scythian comb. We have a little bit of a conflict going on. You think, well, why would the Scythians fight with each other? Why did the Israelites hundreds of years earlier fight with each other? They didn't always get along. Why do they still do it? They don't always get along. All right, you've got your Scythian warriors. Notice this. They're wearing trousers and boots. He's got his pointed hat still on, and he does too. This guy lost his hat. They're in a battle. They were horsemen, and they were very good horsemen. The Scythian horse archers were the terror of the Russian steppes. And you've got a horse here, and there is a horse that's croaked over on his back. That's pretty realistic art. And notice these little guys here. Those are lions, crouched down, holding up the rest of the comb. No, the whole thing's about this big. But it is quite amazing artwork. Dating the Scythian art coincides with the Assyrian invasions in the early 700s BC into Syria, Phoenicia, and northern Israel. Sometimes it's called Neo-Assyrian art because they changed the art of Syria. They brought their art, Israelite artisans ended up in Assyria and changed the art to a significant degree. It's also called Phoenician art. You say, well, why, if it's Phoenician, then maybe they did it and it wasn't the Israelites. Bear in mind the word Phoenicia came from the Greeks. That's what the Greeks call it. And they pronounce it, as I understand it, Phoenicia. And that was their name for Tyre and Sidon and the entire territory of what was the ancient nation of Israel. That whole stretch of the coastline was Phoenicia. It wasn't just the Lebanon area, like we tend to think of it and use it. We use it to refer to Tyronians and Sidonians. For the Greeks, it was the whole stretch. So when they say Phoenician art, that is going to include the Israelites. Similar to the Celtic art, that's Celtic. One of the things that they used is zoomorphic juncture. Zoomorphic juncture. Zoomorphic? Whatever it is. It's got two O's. That means animals connected to each other. Inversion, bending the rear part of the body. Animal arrangement in the form of a cross or a swirl. This wouldn't be a Christian cross typically, but it is just a decoration. A recumbent posture, leaning back like the dead horse. Lotus and palmette, they had flowers sometimes. Lions, fallow deer, roosters, raptors, and fabulous composite creatures called griffins. It didn't exist, but, you know, there are a couple of them on the British coat of arms. This is a torque. Torques were used to hold on capes. We have your Scythian torque here, you've got your lions there, and here you have tiny horsemen on the torque that is the Celtic court. And when it says Hallstatt, there are two Celtic societies recognized by archaeologists. One is older than the other, and I've forgotten. I think Hallstatt comes second, and Latin comes earlier. Celtics, 200 B.C., and the Scythian plaque, that's actually off of a bridle for the Scythian one. Again, somewhat similar. You can see the connections. Here we have a Scythian deer in the zoomorphic juncture and all wound up, probably used as a buckle on the other side. And this is an illustration out of the Book of Kells, the oldest known Celtic book. Beautifully illustrated. They're like cats. Talk about lions. Well, here's a cat. There's a cat. There's another cat there. Here's a cat here. There's a cat. There are ears. There's got to be a cat there, too. I counted eight of them once when I went through that. That is the first letter of the Book of Kells. Notice the swirl, the recumbent posture of these cats in there. I don't know why they wanted cats, but they liked cats. So the Book of Kells is a very famous Celtic book. I think actually the oldest one. Linguistics, very important. It was Sharon Turner in 1827, 1820s, early 1830s, that through his studies established that the place of Armenia called Sakasina in ancient times, mentioned by Strabo, a Roman historian, seems to give a geographical locality to our primeval ancestors. The Persian words that occur in the Saxon language are the evidence of that. So he compared Old Persian, which was actually very heavily influenced, hugely influenced by Hebrew, Old Persian with the Saxon language, and said, therefore, the ancestors of the English are the Scyths, or the Scythians. And that everybody agreed. Sharon Turner's work was considered to be preeminent, still is. More modern times, we have linguistic historian Terry Blodgett of Southern Utah University wrote a thesis in 1981, The Phonological Similarities in Germanic and Hebrew. His findings, one-third of the underlying structure of Germanic languages, that will include English, of course, Danish, Dutch, German, and perhaps one or two others, but mainly them. One-third of the underlying structure are derived from Hebrew. Some examples, and I went through his thesis and picked out just a few of the examples here. We have ba'ash in Hebrew, but the counter word in English is bashful or abashed. Rab is rabble. You know, they're just a bunch of rabble, we would say. That's straight from the Hebrew. If you're good at want to add things up, you're going to suffer or cipher. The old word for arithmetic is do your ciphers. If your arm gets bumped, it might be tsur or sore in English. If you're cold, you might shaver in Hebrew, but you'll shiver in English. See how similar they are? If you don't feel well, you're going to puke in Hebrew and puke in English. It'll smell the same. If you overcook your meat on the barbecue, it will be chada in Hebrew or charred in English. If you can't hear, you might be dumb or dumb in English. Eretz is the Hebrew for earth. So you see, this is just a sampling. There were pages and pages of his research. They're quite fascinating. Hebrew and English are very close in that regard. That's a huge map track right there. Historical maps. Mostly we owe the usefulness of historical maps and the existence of them to Claudius Ptolemaeus in Alexandria, a Roman geographer in the 2nd century A.D. He believed in a round earth. You'll see that on some of his maps as we go through them. Geography was his main work in 8 volumes. That's where the word geography pretty well came from. He had access to ancient sources, either writings or other maps, that went back hundreds of years before him, which were themselves based on maps from people who had drawn them hundreds of years before them. So this is the window to maps of antiquity, is the seminal work by by Ptolemy, and then you add in comments and descriptions by other ancient philosophers or historians to fill out the maps. This is a view of the world. You can see the Mediterranean up here, the Gulf of Suez, and over here is the Indian Ocean, Persian Gulf there, a little bit out of size rise, but considering you didn't have satellite photos to work from, it's not bad. And that's one of Ptolemy's maps. You can look at them on the internet. Just look up Ptolemy, P-T-E-O-L-Y. Well, you've got it there in the handout. Look him up and look at some of the maps. You'll see what he did. Here's another one of his, based on his anyway, which shows Africa pretty accurately and the Middle East. A little bit odd on Asia. Looks a little bit like a whole big elephant. Europe is pretty accurate, though. I'm not sure where this is. I looked it up. Oh, yes, that's Asia Minor. I'm sorry, because you see Pontus Euxus up there at the top. You can't see them very well. They're in gray. But that's Asia Minor. This is I got no idea. Can't read Latin. That's Spain. I know that. Pretty good for Spain. Now, our maps were drawn off of Ptolemy's. That's why we, for historical atlases, that's what they work off of. Here is a map that shows the movements of the Israelites. Israel is here. There's Judah, and this was northern Israel. And then you have the Israelite exiles here, and the Israelite second captivity here, further over into Media. The original ones were in the river Abor and Ola, just according as it is according to Kings and Chronicles. The Jews were put down through here. They were the third captivity, which came 130 years later. We have then the movements. This is 650 B.C. This is before the Jews have been taken into captivity. But the Israelites rose up. As they repopulated in their territories of exile, they then were drafted into the army. And they go into the army, they rise up through the ranks, they became politically influential. They helped to bring down the Assyrian Empire with the aid of the Medes and the Babylonians. And then they began to spread. The Cimmerians broke out early, and they moved into Asia Minor. Ultimately, they moved on over into Europe. The Scythians began to break loose and form their initial kingdoms here because they were going to go up into that area initially. That was called Scythia. The Saka, which are the Scythians east of the Caspian Sea, including the Massagete, they were all Saka in one sense, began to move out that direction, off that side of the Assyrian Empire. Here we have another map, ancient Israel's escape from Media and the first European settlement. So here they are breaking out here. They go up through the Caucasus Mountains there, the pass of Israel through there, and then ultimately on over into Eastern Europe, going around the Black Sea, or partly across it, as the case might be. Scythian archery was one of the reasons why they were a powerful grouping of people. They, you notice the arrow, the bow and arrow there? The bow is about a meter long, I would say, maybe 40 inches, if you're going to shoot a lion. They were terrifying with those bows. Herodotus, in 450 B.C., Greek historian, visited and lived with the Scyths on the eastern side of the Black Sea for a while, a couple of years. And in order for one of their warriors, maybe I described this the other day, no, that was in Cincinnati, to become a Scythian warrior, a young man had to fire three arrows at 60 bow lengths. A bow is a meter long or a little more, that's going to be 65 to 70 yards. That's a long bow shot even today. Long bow shot. And he had to hit the target every time. And he had to be riding a horse. And he had to have the third arrow in the air before the first arrow hit the target. That's hard to do, considering he's pulling a bow that probably pulled well over 100 pounds. I do archery, so I have some feeling for that. There's an illustration of what a Scythian archer would have looked like, stringing those tiny bows that they carried. Tiny but powerful. The Turkish bow today is based on the Scythian design. There's a Greek representation of it. And notice the pointy hat. has been curled up so it would fit on the illustration. Using a hip quiver, and they'd use hip quivers, both that and saddle quivers, when they were in battle. Here we have 300 B.C. The empire of Alexander has moved through. Alexander actually co-opted a great number of the Scythian armies and used them in his own army. That pushed the Sakha further toward China for a while, the Scythians a little further north. The Cimmerians are now in Europe. The Gauls and the Celts are settled over there. And then waiting to fight it out with Rome, Julius Caesar conquered the Gauls in France. But that was not for another 250-some years. Here we have some of the movements of the tribes, some sea routes they would have taken, because there was some sailing that involved in the moving of them and the escaping of them. So you have various ways the Israelites would ultimately end up in northwestern Europe. This is simply a map of France, largely, with some of the names of the clans that existed in Gaul. Celtic Britain, let me point out a couple here. I mentioned the Iceni right there. They were just part of Simeon. The Parisi, that would have been actually a part of Manasseh. He had a son or a grandson named Peresh. And Peresh would be the Parisi. Paris is where it came from, that name, more than likely. Some of these would stay in England. Some would move back to the continent. Remember, they were mobile. And they did shift. 150 B.C., we have the rise of the Parthian Empire taking shape at 150 B.C. Actually, been in existence for 100 years by this time. Rome is still a republic. Parthians are an empire. Rome is a republic. You never studied Parthia in school, but that was the one empire Rome could never conquer, which really irked them. But they're still a republic. They're still fighting with Carthage down here. Actually, I guess by 150 B.C. they would have vanquished Carthage on the North African coast. The Parthians, let's talk about them. Scythian origins, rose to power with the aid of the Massagetae, again, a very powerful contingent of the Scythians. Arch rival to Rome, mounted archers, and there's an example of the Scythian archers, just like Parthian archer, just like the Scythian archers. Wiped out an entire legion of Roman soldiers in 53. And they were an empire from 250 B.C. to 226 A.D. That means they were at the height of their power at the time Christ was born. The wise men would have come out of Parthia from the east, because that was what east was. This is the Parthian shot. The way they fought the Roman soldiers, the Romans had big shields. They'd throw their shield walls up in front when they were in danger. And then the ranks behind the front ranks would bring their shields up high until they were an armored unit. And they could deflect javelins even, as well as arrows. So the Parthians would charge at them and pull up their horses just within javelin range. And they would mill around like they were confused. And, of course, the Romans couldn't resist that. So they would drop shields and they would to throw their javelins. And as they did that, the Parthians would turn around and zap, 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 zap. Fire, rapid-fire arrows right into the unguarded ranks of the front of the Roman army, and which would riddle that part of the Roman army and deflate it pretty badly. That was their technique of fighting a Roman-style soldier. Notice the hip quiver that and tie attached to a saddle. By A.D. 150, the Parthian Empire still exists, but it's on its wane. Rome is very big. But you have the Sakha, the Alans, the Roxolani, the Celts here, the Gauls there, the Goths there, the Teutons up in Scandinavia. As the tribes are beginning to move in, by 300 AD you have the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths in northern Europe. The Gauls are still there, the Alans are still out where they are. And the Alans wouldn't be only the tribe of Zebulun, it would be a grouping of elements of tribes that were labeled under the Alans. Persian Empire has replaced the Parthian Empire by about 70 years now. In 500 AD, you have the sweep of all the various barbarians, as they were called by the Romans and the Greeks, sweep in, sack Rome repeatedly over, about 100 years' time. This is kind of a composite map. You have the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes in the north attacking England and establishing their settlements there. The Vandals were the red line that comes down through the middle. They ended up having an empire in North Africa for about 80 years before they disappeared. They just built boats and floated away. And about that time, then a new population surge ended up in England and a couple other places. Anglo-Saxon warrior, tribal and national traits. Here's how we have viewed them. Reuben, we see as the main part of France. Simeon, Wales, and scattered. Levi, attached to Judah, they are the Kohans. The priestly line of Judah would be the Kohans. So whenever you see, like, James C. Kohan, who was a famous actor, he's from a priestly family of Levites. Cohen, Kohan, Kohn, variations on that. Judah, of course, is mostly the Jews, with a few scattered because of the Jews. Dan would be largely in Ireland, mainly southern, a little bit of northern, Denmark, and mostly in the USA and Australia. I should have Australia on there, too. Naphtali is either Norway or Sweden. And a couple of these, there are some variation on the amount of research we used to do in the past to label the nations was very short in most cases. Gad could be Sweden, or we used to think it was Switzerland. But one historian thinks it's Sweden, and he makes a good case. He studies the movements of the clans. Asher, either Belgium or Scotland, variations there, although Belgium could be Benjamin, because Benjamin had a son named Belach, became the father of the Belge, from which we get the name Belgium and the people. Issachar, Finland, and possibly Switzerland. Zebulun, that one's clear, Holland. Benjamin, included among others, Normans invading England, but Benjamin mostly is with Judah. Joseph would be the U.S. and the U.K. Manasseh means making forgetful. We know that. Joseph said that's why he named him that, meaning that we can forget our differences quickly, which leads to a lot of fair play in the country. It's one of the great strengths. You know, we had a war between the states. But for all practical purposes, that has been forgotten. Now, some would say, no, it hasn't. Oh, yes, it has. Go compare that to what they fought over in the 1990s in Yugoslavia. They were refighting a battle that took place in a war in 1310. They don't forget. You know, for practical purposes, we forget our differences. Reunite and move forward. And that's partly based on Isaac, in a sense of humor and sense of fair play and the rule of law. Now, Manasseh comes from the root word noshe, meaning movement from its proper place. And that's the noshe is the nerve that they call the sciatic nerve. The Jews believe, the rabbis believe, that when Christ, well, they wouldn't call him Christ, but when God pushed his leg out of joint, he pushed on the sciatic nerve of Jacob when they were wrestling. So they still call that nerve the noshe. Noshim is one of the words for women. And the reason is that when a woman marries, she moves her identity from its proper place, it's hers, and gives it to her husband to represent her. So that's why she takes on his name. Now, you think, oh, that's a position of weakness. No, actually it's a position of strength. She is now his creditor. He owes her. I give you my identity to represent. Now you owe me responsible representation. I delegate my identity to you, the delegated responsible representation. That's the core of the American frame of government. And in the New Testament, Christ said the apostles would each rule one of the tribes. James, the book of James, is addressed to the 12 tribes scattered abroad. Read Romans, and I've got those scriptures listed on the handout, chapters 9, 10, and 11. And he talks about the tribes of Israel. When he says Israel there, he doesn't just mean the Jews. He means all of Israel. So you see in the New Testament, we find it as well. And we'll zoom through all that I just said, because we're coming up to the very end of this. Oh, I forgot. And in Jerusalem, the gates to the New Jerusalem will each be named after one of the 12 tribes. Tribe tracking in the future. God will let us find the tribes in the second Exodus and restore them to their homelands. And that will be a time when Israel has been lost and is now found. Remember 9/11? One of the ministers that was in the National Prayer Service that was held in Washington about 2 days after the tragedy, He quoted this. A voice was heard in Ramah, Jeremiah 31. Lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted for her children because they are no more. And then it goes on to say later in verse 17, there is hope in your future. Now, is Rachel's children were Joseph and Benjamin, but by extension it applies to all the tribes of Israel, and frankly then, by extension, to all the tribes of whatever lineage. There is hope in your future, says the Lord, that your children shall come back to their own border. And that's the essence that brings us right up into the millennial age, when they will come back, and we, as resurrected saints, will be helping Christ to rule them, teach them, and guide them, and bring them also to ultimately repentance and conversion and their day of salvation. So that's the Tribe Tracker's guide to history. If God works in history, He can work in your life too. So thank you for your attention, and we have our break before services now.